Hi, this is John Irwin, and you're listening to History or Something Like It.
Hello, and welcome to the History or Something Like It podcast. I'm your host, Chris Cowan, and I want to say thank you for checking out the show. As you probably know by now, this podcast focuses on historical people, places, items, and events. Now that you know where the history part of our name comes from, you may be asking yourself, okay, but what about the or something like it part of our name? Well, part of this show deals with answering and debunking certain claims made in regards to historical events and artifacts. We will be attempting to do that in this episode of History or Something Like It as we look into the election of 1824 and see if there was really a conspiracy to steal the White House from Andrew Jackson and give the presidency to John Quincy Adams. As James Monroe's second term in office began its conclusion, the citizens of the United States watched its five contenders vied for the presidency. John Quincy Adams, John Calhoun, and William Crawford would each enter the presidential race, touting pedigrees that held positions in Monroe's administration. Speaker of the House Henry Clay and war hero Andrew Jackson would also run for the highest office in American politics. Though all five men were of the same party, the views in certain aspects of the national interests varied. As the nation voted for their next president, something peculiar happened. Jackson, who had won the popular vote, had also received the most electoral votes, yet he did not meet the required number necessary to win the election, winning 99 of the 131 required votes needed to secure the White House. Adams would trail Jackson with 84 votes, Crawford would place third with 41, and Clay would ultimately come in last with 37 votes. Calhoun, who had realized that the presidency would be unobtainable, had dropped from the race and ran as vice president, a position he would win with ease. America faced a dilemma. A vice president was elected, but a president had not been. The three highest-placing candidates would be put to a vote in the House of Representatives. Clay would be eliminated from the race, and Crawford, who had suffered a stroke the year before, was viewed as medically unfit for office. Adams and Jackson were the only two remaining viable candidates, and though Jackson had won the popular vote, as well as more electoral votes than Adams, Adams would win the race for the presidency. In an era of renewed American patriotism and idolatry towards the spirit of 1776, the man who had been the people's choice did not win, leading many to claim that a conspiracy had resulted in Adams' election. To understand why the House vote for Adams was so controversial, one must place themselves into the mental state of the American populace at the time. Leading into the election of 1824, the American people fondly reminisced about the days of the Revolutionary War. An air of romanticism encompassed the young nation as they remembered the heroes who helped to free and create American democracy. The approaching visit of the Marquis de Lafayette helped fan the fires of nostalgia, and a rekindled sense of patriotism blanketed the nation. As professor of history at Marquette University, Robert Hayes notes that although Lafayette did not arrive in the United States until August of 1824, the anticipation of his visit preoccupied the American people for many months. Lafayette's arrival was met with celebration, not just at the docks upon his arrival, but throughout the entire country. Veterans of the American Revolution were honored in his place, and parades and celebrations filled the streets of cities and towns in every state. As veneration for those who fought in 1776 increased, so too did the comparisons between the presidential candidates and those who fought for our nation's independence. Americans began likening their preferred candidates to those who held the honors and sentiments of the Founding Fathers. As Hayes notes, since the friend of all the contenders insisted that they favored the man whose principles approximated the nearest to the primitive republicanism of the Revolution, why not allow the venerable veterans of 76 to select the next president? John Quincy Adams was the son of former President John Adams, a well-respected revolutionary. Andrew Jackson, the only candidate who actually fought in the war, carried a saber wound he received on his forehead that he had obtained from a British officer while he was a prisoner of war. Similar comparisons to the nation's founders would be gifted to John Calhoun, Henry Clay, and William Crawford as well. Richard Penn Smith would write a long list of accolades promoting Clay, for example, in the General Advertiser, concluding his accolades with, "We support him because he is an honest and able American patriot." It would be through this air of patriotism that many would call it a conspiracy when John Quincy Adams won the presidency. His placing behind Jackson in the electoral and popular votes showcased the candidate who won against the will of the people. Surely, the Founding Fathers, in the eyes of many Americans, would be outraged at the silencing of the people's voice. Now, it's well established that before the U.S. House of Representatives voted on the matter, Adams held a meeting with Henry Clay, the excluded candidate who also happened to be Speaker of the House. Although the details of the meeting are unknown, rumors spread of a corrupt bargain being struck between the two politicians. An unknown congressman, later identifying himself to be George Cramer of Pennsylvania, wrote a letter to Philadelphia's Columbian Observer in which he claimed that Adams had offered Clay the position of Secretary of State in exchange for his support in the House election. Clay denied these charges and defensively threatened a duel with the as-of-yet-anonymous congressman should he be discovered. Was there any validity to Cramer's accusations of a corrupt bargain? There is some rather compelling evidence that there was an illicit deal struck between Clay and Adams. 2 weeks after Clay and Adams' meeting on January 9, 1825, Clay had written a letter to James Brown stating that, "I can tell you nothing of the formation of the new cabinet. I believe that, if I choose to go into it, I can enter in any situation that I may please." It would appear to Clay that his meeting with Adams had guaranteed him a high-ranking position in Adams' administration. Even more damning, though, were rumors that Clay's aides visited with Jackson afterwards to see what kind of deal for a position in his administration could be struck, with Jackson reportedly dismissing the men in anger. Between the meeting with Adams and the accusations of a meeting with Jackson, Clay was believed to be corrupt and working with Adams to steal the election. If the previous accusations were not enough, another condemning bit of evidence against Clay would be that preceding the House vote, Clay and Daniel Webster pulled New York Representative Stephen Van Rensselaer into Clay's office. Van Rensselaer would be the deciding vote in giving Adams the presidency. Upon the announcement of the vote results, that Adams would be the next president, Van Rensselaer begged aloud, "Forgive me." And John Randolph, who tallied the votes with Webster, declared that the cards were stacked. Between Cramer's accusations of backroom dealings, rumors of Clay seeking political favors, and the reactions of Van Rensselaer and Randolph, it would appear that Henry Clay abused his position as Speaker of the House to give Adams the presidency. What was previously speculation and accusation cemented itself in the minds of many when just 5 days after the vote, Adams asked Clay to be his Secretary of State. Before being sworn into office, many were already crying foul. John Norvell's editorial in the Aurora and Franklin Gazette, published on February 16, 1825, discusses the theft of the presidency from Jackson and that justice would come to Jackson in 1828. In the mind of many across the nation, the charges of a corrupt bargain appeared to be true. The evidence of a conspiracy between Adams and Clay appears convincing, at least initially, but upon further review, all evidence becomes circumstantial at best and non-existent at worst. Much of the supposed evidence comes from second and even third-hand accounts. What can be established is that Clay did meet with Adams a month before the House vote. The topic of discussion in this meeting remains unknown, but Adams was serving as Secretary of State and Clay was Speaker of the House. This very well may have been a meeting that was strictly business. Even if this meeting was an attempt by Adams to befriend Clay, this is an act that Jackson would take as well, who hosted Clay as a guest of honor at a dinner party. George Cramer's accusations concerning the details of the meeting are unverified as Cramer was not present. When called before an investigative committee, Cramer refused to appear. If he truly had knowledge of a corrupt bargain, then wouldn't it be a sign of integrity and honesty to appear? Feeling that Cramer was a patsy of agents acting on Jackson's behalf, Clay would never challenge him to the issued duel. The meeting in which Clay and Adams supposedly came to terms suffers from another problem as well. When it became apparent that the House of Representatives would have to vote for the president, Clay immediately decided to support Adams. With Clay's support already secured, what benefit would Adams have had to strike any deal? He already had what he wanted. Anything else would be a losing proposition. Clay's support for Adams was a simple choice for Clay. He held a strong dislike of Andrew Jackson, but more importantly, he saw Adams as a safe bet for his own political goals, thinking that an Adams presidency would increase his chances of winning the office of president in the future run. Supporting Adams gave Clay the benefits that he desired. There was no need for a corrupt bargain. Adams himself would write of his meeting with Clay, stating that the latter offered his support without any personal considerations for himself. So if the meeting between Adams and Clay can be explained and examined through eyes other than those of the non-attending George Cramer, What of Clay's comment to James Brown? Clay's comment about joining the Adams administration in a position of his choosing could have been simply boasting to friends. Clay had taken a liking to the praise all the candidates were showering him with, as they believed the Speaker of the House had a powerful influence on the House vote. While Clay certainly had influence among members of the House, even Clay was sure that his sway was not as great as some made it seem. He would go on to state that, "They all believe that my friends have the power of deciding the question, and that I have the power of controlling my friends." Proponents of a conspiracy to steal the election make note of a shift in support away from Jackson and towards Adams after his meeting with Clay, and see this as evidence of a shady secret deal. While this can be viewed as a sign of foul play, it is important to remember that during this time, John Quincy Adams was still actively campaigning for office. Jackson, on the other hand, had stopped campaigning personally due to suffering hemorrhaging from a bad fall that had left him bedridden. This gave Adams the advantage of being the sole candidate to actively continue to campaign, as Crawford and Jackson were both suffering from medical ailments. With regards to the pre-vote meeting between Clay, Webster, and Van Rensselaer, it could be assumed that Van Rensselaer had been pressured into voting for Adams as Clay and Webster had hoped. This would provide an explanation for his outburst begging for forgiveness. While his vote and outburst could be seen as evidence of a conspiracy, Van Rensselaer's actions leading up to the vote suggest instead that he was a man without a spine. Van Rensselaer had made a habit of agreeing to support the candidate whose supporters were closest to him at the time. As Greg points out, Van Rensselaer had indicated to his brother that he would probably support Clay, though earlier he told Federalists he favored John C. Calhoun. But by late January 1825, the old patroon admitted that, "I feel inclined for Old Hickory." In a meeting with Adams 5 days prior to the vote, Van Rensselaer had promised he would vote for Adams, a promise that Van Rensselaer mentioned the day after the House vote. It is worth noting, though, that Van Rensselaer had shared a boarding house with Lewis McLean and Martin Van Buren, who both were under the impression that Van Rensselaer would vote for Crawford. It would appear that Van Rensselaer lacked the conviction to think for himself or the fortitude to support his beliefs, whatever they may have been during the election, and instead focused on keeping those in his immediate vicinity happy with him. His meeting with Clay and Webster can then be seen as little more than ensuring that he kept his promise that he made to Adams, or, knowing of his wishy-washy attitude, being the last to speak to him to help secure an Adams vote. The most damning piece of evidence towards a corrupt bargain would be Clay's acceptance of the position of Secretary of State. The rumor had spread of a deal before the House vote. Adams was not the kind of man to promise such positions because he didn't want to owe anyone. He did vaguely state to Clay that, "With regard to the formation of an administration, if I should be elected by the suffrages of the West, I should naturally look to the West for much of the support that I should need." This ambiguous wording may be what gave Clay the fortitude to brag in his letter earlier mentioned. Or Clay may have simply enjoyed bragging, as it was well known that he was enjoying the praise offered to him due to his position as Speaker of the House. It does not, however, show direct evidence of a bargain. While the argument could be made that it was implied, quoting out of context can turn any phrase against its intended meaning. Even with Clay accepting the position, there are troubles supporting any shady dealings. In December of 1824, Clay would say that, "I would not cross Pennsylvania Avenue to be in any office under any administration which lies before us." Initially, Clay did not want to be Secretary of State or hold any other office in Adams' cabinet. By February of the following year, Clay would have a change of heart on the matter, though, and state, "I had perhaps remained long enough in the House of Representatives, and that my own section would not be dissatisfied with seeing me placed where, if I should prove myself possessed of the requisite attainments, my services might have a more extended usefulness." This change of heart, coupled with the rumors of a secret deal, were enough to secure the belief of corruption in the election of Adams to the presidency. It would, however, seem that Clay's change of heart came from support and pressure from his friends, more so than any political mayhem. Francis Blair, for example, would write to Clay that, "Our friends here all concur in the wish to see you Secretary of State." This is not to mention that Clay's political resume was extremely impressive, and he likely would have been asked to be a cabinet member in any of the candidates' administrations. Political corruption and rumors of conspiracies are vast and ancient, reaching back in time to the first man who led a tribe of other men. The election of 1824 would provide yet another conspiracy charge for the history books. With each charge and piece of evidence, however, there is an alternative excuse for why certain actions appeared to the conspiracy theorists in the manner that they did. With all the facts weighed together, any conspiracy of a corrupt bargain begins to falter and weaken. When weighed against the beliefs of the time in regards to the renewed romanticism of the American Revolution, any type of backroom dealing would have been seen as tyranny and a slap in the face of the Founding Fathers. It would be from this vantage point that Adams would not be re-elected in 1828, instead replaced by Andrew Jackson, who many felt had been robbed of the office in 1824. Adams' term in the White House, along with Clay's position as Secretary of State, would never lose the stigma of corruption that was attained by what was likely an imagined conspiracy. Clay's attempt to play it safe with supporting Adams to secure his own hopes for a future presidential run would fail. With 1828 came the election of Andrew Jackson, and with him, the birth of the two-party system in American politics. I'm Chris Cowan, and this has been History or Something Like It. Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review us on iTunes. You can also contact us on our website, historyorsomethinglikeit.com. This show is made possible by our listeners, and we appreciate all the support that we can get. So if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend or family member about us. Visit us at our website, like us on Facebook, and if you feel so inclined, support us on Patreon. We greatly appreciate any level of support that you are able to provide us with. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back with a new episode soon.